The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Okay, we're talking about the Shema, and today's class will be dealing with the second paragraph of the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, testifies to the oneness of God, the oneness that includes. Baruch Shem Kavod suggests a more singular sense of God as a one God, but as a monarch God. Once I know the truth of divine oneness, I am then able to accept the commandment to love God. How is that possible? Because once you know that you are one with God, although not one the same as God, then one could be commanded to love God. The commandment means behave in a manner that will bring to surface in the world and bring to surface in your consciousness this transcendental oneness that includes. Okay? The first sentence of the first paragraph tells us that we should love God to the extent of heart, soul, and might or money. The second sentence and the third, fourth, fifth then clarify, and how do you do that? Right? It's through the study of Torah, it's through the performance of mitzvot. Okay. One envelops themselves in Torah consciousness. Now we move to the second paragraph, and the second paragraph is of a communal sense. The first paragraph is the singular. The second paragraph is in the plural, so it's addressing the community. And I will basically paraphrase it. I won't read it in Hebrew, but I'll translate it as I'm going along. And it shall be, if you listen, you will listen to my commandments that I've commanded you today, to love God, your God, in plural, your God, and to serve Him with all your heart and with all your souls, all your hearts and souls. And I shall give rain in its time, early and later rains, and you shall gather in your grains, your vineyards, and your olive groves. And I shall give grass in the field for your animals, for your cows, and you shall eat and be satisfied. Hishamru, watch out, lest you shall let your heart stray, and you have turned from the service and served other gods and bowed down to them. And the divine will be angered, and he will stop up the heaven, and it will no longer give rain, and the ground will no longer give its produce, and you shall be quickly cast off from the good land that I had promised to give you, that God promised to give you. And therefore you shall put these words on your hearts and on your souls, and you shall tie them as a sign on your arms, and as totafot between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, speaking in them when you're sitting in your house, when you're going on the way, when you're lying down, when you're getting up. And you shall write them on your doorposts of your house and on your gates, in order to increase your days and the days of your children on the land that God promised to your forefathers to give to them as the days of heaven on earth. That's the second paragraph. The second paragraph addresses the community. The first paragraph is the individual's responsibility to love God and the way to reach that. The second paragraph is a communal responsibility. But what is the basic innovation of the second paragraph? What's new about this second paragraph, other than the fact that it's plural? What's new in the second paragraph that was not mentioned in the first paragraph? Reward and punishment. If you keep my commandments, then you will be rewarded. And if you don't keep my commandments, then there will be some kind of punishment. Now, when we read this very carefully, we can't help but be a little disappointed. It says, and if you do my commandments, if you fulfill my commandments, you will get rain in its time. I mean, this is almost as disappointed as playing Let's Make a Deal. They call you down, come on down. And you get there and you say, well, okay, can you tell us for our contestants, you know, what is in store for them? Right? And behind door number one is, yes, rain in its time. Hey! You know, oh, come on, rain in its time. Right? Well, what else do I get, I mean, if I win this? Well, okay, behind door number two is grass for your cows. Grass for my cows. Grass for my cows. All right, let them play the game. Why am I playing this game for my grass? You know. And what else? You. Yes, you. Nobody else. But you will go out there and labor and get the produce of the land. And you'll eat and be satisfied. You won't get any more than what's satisfying. It's a little disappointing. I mean, here I am holding back. Every time I walk by a McDonald's, knowing that 3 million or billion have been served today, a Big Mac, and I hold back to serve God, I don't eat that Big Mac, and what do I get? Rain in its time? I mean, you know, McDonald's gives me a Ronnie McDonald mug. There's something to that, you know? Don't pass it up. I mean, you know, rain in its time? This is the reward for mitzvahs, rain in its time, grass in the fields for my cows. I mean, where's the olam haba? Where's the world to come? Where's the celestial delights? Where is, I don't know, the treasures of the afterlife? Or I don't know, what about treasures in this life? Where's all the excitement? It really leaves us disappointed. It's really hard to encourage people to do mitzvot by telling them to wait for rain in its time. Let's face it. Can you imagine? I go out there and tell people, you know, do the mitzvahs. What do you get? Rain in its time. And I want you to understand that there's no place in the entire written Bible that says you get anything more than this. Makes it even more frightening. There's no place in the Bible that says that you'll get the world to come for mitzvot. There's no place in the Bible that says you'll get the Garden of Eden for your mitzvot. No place in the Bible that says you'll get the revival of the dead, you'll get the Messiah, I don't know, nothing. There's only one place that says you'll get lengthened days. Could mean they'll send you to the North Pole. I don't know what that means. A long day. Many people have, it's been a long day. Well, what does that mean, lengthened day? Well, generally it's understood. Lengthened days, of course, interpreted as you enjoy eternity or you have a longer life. But even that's still interpretation. It's just as long, lengthened days. So we must address the very serious issue. Why is it in the written Bible there is no mention of the world to come, the revival of the dead, the Gan Eden experience after death, nor the Messianic age? None of this is mentioned in the written Bible. In the oral tradition, of course it's mentioned. In the written tradition, it's not. If it's not written in the written tradition, then there are two ways to go. There's the biblical critical way of saying, well, that just goes to show you that Judaism really made up the world to come much later on in its history. It's not part of the authentic original Judaism. And it's all the rabbinical stuff that's hooked on later on. Of course, traditional Jews don't accept that. That seems a little weird, right? To come up with all these ideas that have no founding, especially when you appreciate the level of honesty and precision that oral tradition takes, it's a little unrealistic. But there's another approach. The approach is that the written Bible intentionally does not want to say anything about these things to teach you something about the relation between the mitzvot and these more celestial rewards. What do you think it is? Why is it that the written Bible does not mention these things?
Because fulfilling the mitzvot is the reward in itself.
Excellent. Excellent. To clarify an educational concern. All right. Give that guy a Hershey bar. Kol hakavod. What? Great. The reward of a mitzvah is the mitzvah. The Bible is being educational. It does not want people to spend their time doing mitzvahs out of the motivation of some kind of futuristic reward. Don't serve the master in order to get a prize. So it says in Pirkei Avot, in Chapters of the Fathers. Rather serve the master in order not to receive a prize. You do it for the sake of the mitzvah itself. Jews were not preoccupied and should not be preoccupied with the world to come, the messianic age. Right? This is not a preoccupation of the Jewish people. Of course, we're aware of it. But it's not the motivation. It's not the drive. There's a Hasidic story about the Baal Shem Tov. I don't remember the details, but somehow the Baal Shem Tov found himself in a situation which was considered a transgression, and a voice came out of the sky and said, Baal Shem Tov, you have just lost your portion in the world to come. The Baal Shem Tov started to dance, right, with joy. This fellow looks at him, sees the Baal Shem Tov in such ecstasy of happiness. He says, what's going on? He says, I just lost my world to come. Did you imagine that? The guy looks at him real odd, you know, like, what? He says, don't you understand? Now that I know I'm not getting the world to come, I can serve God for the sake of serving God in this world. For the sake of that. No longer is it my concern. When I thought maybe I'll get the world to come, so I wasn't pure. Now that I know I'm not, now I can really do the mitzvah out of the purity of my heart just for the sake of the mitzvah itself. And then, of course, a voice came out of the sky and said, Baal Shem Tov, you've just re-earned your world to come. Ugh, you were so down. No, I'm just... You know, Nietzsche critiqued religion for robbing human beings of life right here, right now. Through these fancy promises of futuristic rewards, men will sit around waiting. People won't make the best out of this world because there's this sense there's the next world, there's the next world. And he felt a holy mission to tell people there is no next world. To refocus them into this world. What you've got to do is this world. Everybody likes to talk about the next world. This world. Sure, in Judaism we believe this world is a hallway, the next world is the palace. But you've got to be in this world. It's only through the hallway that you're going to get into the palace. So, the first approach is the Torah is being educational. Of course one gets the world to come for the mitzvot. Of course there is the revival of the dead, and there are very beautiful, wonderful, mystical, futuristic events on their way. But we don't want to harper on that. We don't see that as the goal. We see mitzvahs for the sake of mitzvah, for the sake of this world. If a person says, well, you see, Jews do the mitzvahs because they'll get this great world in the future, so I guess it's worth wrecking your life in this world for the next world. And all the sacrifice that one has to deal with and accept in their lives right now, I guess it's worth it. I mean, you get some kind of eternal world later. For those people who are not still sure about an eternal world, it's a hard sales pitch. You know what I mean? Do them! Wait, eternity, you want eternity, right? I'm not so sure. It's kind of hard for me to be sure that the mitzvot are meaningful in this world. And more than the mitzvahs bring you to the world to come, the mitzvahs bring the world to come to you in this world. Very important. That a religious practicing Jew is not a masochist. Actually enjoys life. and actually believes that the lifestyle of being Jewish is great, is fun, and I wouldn't trade it for a million years. And there's certain things in your life that need certain restraint. But we all know that restraint is also very fruitful and very enjoyable sometimes. We all know that we put ourselves into situations of pressure because we know that that pressure produces more out of ourselves. So there's no doubt that a lifestyle of mitzvah requires restraint and sometimes puts me into situations of pressure. But certainly no more than other lifestyles. Even the most bohemian of lifestyles find themselves forced into situations of restraint and some kind of pressure. So the first approach is it's educational. But there's another approach. Whoever said that the mitzvot give you the world to come in the first place? Where did it ever say that? In fact, the reason why the Bible does not say you're going to get the world to come, because you're not going to get the world to come for your mitzvah. And if the Bible is just being educational, so why did it mention a reward at all? Why did it say you'll get rain? Just say, and you'll do my mitzvahs. Because I have to say, it rain, grass, I mean, that's still something, especially for an agricultural society. So why say anything? Because the truth is that the mitzvot do not give you the world to come. They prepare you for the world to come. The world to come is coming no matter what. The question is, are you prepared? Are you prepared? The mitzvot is a lifestyle which readies me for the next world. This world, and everything about this world, reflects the next world. And to the extent that one lives a whole life, a pure life in this world, to that extent, they will benefit from the next world. People think that the world to come is a place. There's some people go to world to come, some people go to the world to, But the truth is the world to come is a consciousness, a revelation. It's not really a place, but it is a realization, which if you're prepared for will be pleasant. If you are not prepared for will be unpleasant. The same light is going to be revealed. We spoke a little bit on Shabbat about the hidden light. That the original light of creation has been hidden. Why? Because God felt that the evil people would use it wrong. However, in the future, God will once again allow that original light to be revealed. The old tradition says, those who are prepared, those who are righteous, will be delighted in it. Enjoy it. Energized by it. But those who were not righteous, who were not holy, who were not pure, they will be burnt by it. The same light. The same light if your vessels are not ready to receive the light. When it's coming, because it's coming once again, there will be those who will be broken by the light, and those that will be filled by the light. Depends how you reconstructed your vessels in this world. The mitzvot is a way of reconstructing the vessels of life to receive the light in a manner that life will be energized and fulfilled by it rather than destroyed by it. The same vision for one person could be heaven, and for another person could be hell. The same vision. Right? The same vision. What happens in the afterlife is a function of what happened in your life. how you prepared yourself for it. Had you prepared yourself for it? Let's say you identified yourself, you saw your source of self-esteem as your intellect. Let's say you're the greatest accountant in Manhattan. Right? Highest paying accountant of the top accounting firm in the United States of America. You're at the top. Nobody is as efficient, nobody is as precise, as articulate, as quick as you. This is the source of your identity, this is the source of your esteem, this is your source of your dignity. And you're the tops. One day, they walk in, they say, George, you've got some bad news. Oh yeah, why? What's wrong? George, sorry to let you, we got to lay you off. You're being replaced. Replaced? Are you crazy? Who could replace me? I'm the top accountant in the world. What, are you crazy? I mean, just ask me the records of this year. I could tell it to you in 5 minutes. Go ahead, test me. George, I'm really sorry. I know it's a big shock to you, but what can we do? You know, there's certain financial considerations the company has to take. And this is your last month. Well, I mean, who did you find to replace me? I don't understand this. So who could it be? Well, okay. Boys, could you roll in the Sam 51? The Sam 51? What kind of name is a Sam 51? What kind of last name is a 51? And sure enough, what do they bring in? A computer. That's smaller than your thumb. And they put it on your desk. And it says, good morning. Right. So, I don't believe it. This is the Sam 51. This is ridiculous. Right? And then they push a button. And this little computer, in 3 seconds, prints out the last 20 years of the accounting records. Could you imagine the shock? George would probably die on the spot. Right? I mean, how could he deal with it? It's called future shock. It's called future shock. And it's coming. People are every day being shocked into realizing what they thought was the essence and the value of their life is being replaced by a machine. Now, if you thought that the source of your identity was your intellect, if that was the place and the foundation from whence you drew your sense of self and confidence and self-respect, then we all have some bad news coming. Because computers are taking over the world. But there's one thing a computer cannot do, and I can honestly be sure we'll never do. Computers will never love. Never. They might say, I love you. They might even say it with more feeling than human beings. But they don't have more feeling than human beings. Because a computer cannot create relationships. I mean real relationships. A computer cannot know itself as an I and anybody else as a you, and a computer cannot know itself as an I in relationship to an internal you. That a computer will never do. Even though it's kind of hard when you play with computers, you get upset with them. Come on! What's wrong with you? Come on! What are you playing around with me? Right? People start speaking to their computers. And even though nowadays, you know, when you're taking out money from the bank, right, you put your card in, the computer says, sorry. First of all, it says, good day. Right? Hello. Right? Oh, hello. I'm not talking to the computer, right? Then you plug into it, punch the wallet, you know, $100, right? Then it says, sorry, you don't have enough money in your account, right? What do you mean I don't have money in your account? What do you mean by that? Right? Then you push another button, clarity, right? And the computer writes back, right? Sorry, I think I told you already, get lost, Right? Say, oh, what a spunky little computer you are. I'll beat you. Right? What do you do to a computer? There's no relationship, but we feel like it. Right? We start to actually feel like there's somebody inside here, isn't there? There must be someone inside. How do you know that I didn't pay? It's getting frightening. But the facts are the facts. There'll never be a relationship with a computer. Right? Never. When human beings will recognize again that their source of identity is their souls, the consciousness, the sense of responsibility, the consciousness of God, the sense of responsibility to God, and sense of responsibility to the rest of fellow mankind, only then will they tap into the eternity of their identities. Only then, even when their bodies will pass, their souls will go on. Because I am I in relationship to you. As an I in relationship to a you, it goes beyond my body. And as an I in relationship to an eternal you, and that eternal you becomes part of the definition of my finite temporal I. At that point, my I has just tapped into the eternity of its own being. That computers can't do. It's future shock. But another person, when they come in there and say, George, we're sorry, but you're being replaced by a computer, that if you were a real human being, you'd say, oh, thank God. Wonderful. Now I can spend more time and invest in relationships. I had to work so hard and keep all these memories of all kinds of numbers in my head. Great, now it frees me up to dedicate myself to that which only I as a human being could do. Wow. Two different people will have completely different experiences. The Zohar says that when a person dies, the preparation of life is to die. You know, there's a story, a Hasidic story, of Rebbe was about to die, his wife beside him started to cry. He looked at her with the most tranquil, calm face and he says, what are you crying for? Don't you realize my whole life was just in preparation for this moment? This is the beginning, not the end. This is the beginning. Life is a preparation for new life, which happens through what we call death. And it all depends on how prepared you are. You know, there's an oral tradition that says that all the miracles of the future are hinted in this world. So everything that seems very fascinating and mystical already has a natural hint in this world. The hint for the revival of the dead is the butterfly. That caterpillar sheds its skin to find the butterfly within. From our perspective, the caterpillar is dying, right? I mean, that's the end of the caterpillar. We see it go into its coffin. It cocoons. If you would, God forbid, but if you were to cut that cocoon in half, what would you see? Decay. You wouldn't see life in there. And yet, what comes out of the cocoon? New life. Butterfly. When seeds grow, what do? They decay first. When you see a seed in the process of growth, it really looks like it's regressing. It really looks like it's decaying. It looks like it's dying and it's dead. It's only the beginning of new life. So too, for Judaism, death is only turning the page to the new chapter. But certain death experiences will be positive, and certain people's death experience will be very negative. As it says, the tzaddikim leave this world like hair being pulled out of cream. But the evil leave this world like cotton pulled out of thorns. Just your preparation. How much did you identify your soul with your body? How much will it take for the body and the soul to separate? However, I want you to know that the process of death will still be painful for all of us. The various levels of pain determined by the preparation of life and the clarification of who I am in my life. I'm not my body. My body is a vehicle. My body helps me get where I've got to go. But I'm not my body. Got to be really careful to understand. It's not like I'm not my body either. But that identification with the physical world, as if this is who I am, that will be a problem for all of us. The Talmud says that the worms to the side of the deceased is like pins to the side of the living. What does that mean? It means, according to Kabbalah, that you and I are going to witness our death. This is a good class. You and I are going to witness our death, and we are going to witness our funeral, and we will witness the burial of the body, and we will witness its decay. So the Zohar says. Now, if you were Miss or Mr. America, and you really, again, invested in your body, you thought, this is me. Look at me, ah. Ooh, ah, look at me. And you were the pinup all over the world, right? And you are on billboards, television, you look in the mirror, you say, beautiful. Ah, there I am. Well, you don't have to die in order to begin to appreciate the pain as you get older and start to see your face with wrinkles, start to see your hair falling out. What are you going to do then? When all you invested was in your face, and what will happen when that pretty face is no longer as pretty? How will you feel about yourself then? Well, again, if you never really thought it was your pretty face and invested too much time in the pretty face, but invested in a loving face to other people, a positive face, a cheerful face, that face will never grow old. Loving, cheerful faces only get younger. But beautiful physical faces, they get old. It depends how you see yourself, what you did in your life, and how you invested in your life. And then when you die, of course, to see the body of Miss America return to dust, as from whence we all came, will be shocking for Miss America. But not shocking for the person who never saw that as the source of their identity. That's be shocking for us all. But the extent of this vision will determine whether I am in heaven or hell. So we'll watch that. We'll be at the funeral. We'll hear what they said. And boy, will it be a pain to the soul to realize that's a bunch of bull. I never did any of that in my life. Right. Death of a salesman. Nobody shows up at the end of the story. Nobody but a few people. The very few people that he, in fact, in the final end, neglected his whole life. If you're looking for all the strangers to love you, they won't show. All the people, unfortunately, we neglect, they're the ones that will be there at the end. And the ones that we put so much time in, will they really be there? Do we have our priorities straight? So there they are. Maybe 3 friends, or maybe 100 acquaintances that might sit around and say, oh, the old bag's gone. As they argue over whether the coffin will be mahogany or a plastic one. Something that, you know. As they start to fight over where we'll dump the body. or maybe where they really concerned in burying you. The soul hears all this. It's frightening. But sometimes we need a little frightening. Right? So a roller coaster is frightening when people take them. So this is frightening. And then you see the decaying of the body depends. You invested in life depends on what you will see at death. And then, that's only the beginning. We're taking you through the process. You witnessed the funeral. You know, my relatives were at a funeral of somebody. And when everybody got back to the parking lot of the cemetery, all the cars were vandalized. Right? All the cars were vandalized while they were burying this person. And my father-in-law went to a great Kabbalist and said, this is very frightened by, well, what is this all about? He said, probably people did not respect the dead in the burial, which unfortunately was true at that burial. Then the soul witnesses the decaying of the body, but that's only the beginning. Then the Zohar says something really weird. Really weird. All of a sudden, there you are resting. I mean, you wanted to take a good nap. Well, here it is. All of a sudden, you meet two angels pop into your life. They look at you, and they're going to ask you the million-dollar question. What do you think the million-dollar question is? And if you get it right, good. If you get it wrong, the Zohar says they beat you up. Again, I don't suggest we're taking this literally. But then again, you never know. Question is, what's the million-dollar question? What's your name? Anybody forget their name here? Yes. Believe it or not, there will be those of us who will have forgotten our names. You say, my name! Oh, my name! Yeah, well, yeah, it's, wait a second. My name. Hey, don't tell me. I've lived with this name for years. I mean, this is what they call me. My name. Starts with a D, no, a D, my name. Can you imagine? Doesn't that sound ridiculous? How could a person forget their name? It's very easy. Because you know what names are for? People to call you so you can respond. And if you never gave people your name, you never used it, you lose it. Because you were never there for anybody. You were never there. Sure, you wanted people to speak about your name, tell of your name, but to call out your name so that you can respond? Did you invest? What do you think you got a name for if it's not for relationships? What's it for in the first place? If it's not so people can call you and you can respond. Names offer us the ability to respond, names of responsibility. But if I neglected my responsibilities in this world, invested my time in making a lot of money and making a lot of noise so I can be famous, if it's not for relationships, not for caring for people, caring for the world, caring for the source, then what did we use it for in the first place? So we lose it. We forget. Because within the context of the next world, it has no meaning. In this world, we live the illusion that our names could be meaningful so we can put it on a product. So we can put it on a billboard. Names are only meaningful so that people can call you. In the next world, there will be no billboards to put your name on. No big magazine covers. No newspapers. Okay, well then we go on. Then the next stop, after you've been dealing with your name, is certain rabbis metaphorically express that we then go to the movies. We find ourselves in a theater. Of course. This is wonderful. Many of us probably spent most of our lives in theater, so this is great. What's playing? Right? And you're very excited. And everybody's there, friends, family. And you know, this theater could be the theater of heaven or the theater of hell. It depends. You turn to the fellow sitting beside you and say, "Whoa, what's playing?" He says, "You'll see." "Oh yeah? It's a double feature." "A double feature?" "Yeah." "Oh great." And all of a sudden, on the screen, you always wanted to be a star, right? And there you are. You're the star of the show. This is a movie about your life. Yes, this is your life. Welcome to your life. And the double feature is, the first movie is how you indeed lived your life. The second movie is how you could have lived your life. Depending on whether these movies are actually reruns of each other, or they are completely incongruous with each other, they don't match, to that extent will be the heavenly theater, or they will be serving eternal hot popcorn at this one. And you're popping, okay? The next world can be received based on how well we prepared ourselves in this world. The hidden light will either be a confirming light, what I always invested my life in, relation with God, relation with man. And if I built the vessels, which is built through those relationships, through the fulfillment of those kinds of mitzvot, then my vessels can hold the light this time. They won't break. But if I don't, I just enter into the world of light as a bat. And a bat cannot deal with the day. So this world is actually the preparation for the next world. The mitzvot build the vessels so we can receive the light in the next world. It's almost like learning the language in order to appreciate the experience. You know what's so beautiful about poets? Poets are able to receive their experience because they have such a rich vocabulary. When the sun is setting, because they have such a rich storehouse of words to receive that experience and articulate it to themselves and to others, they're able to get and receive more of what's really being offered when that sun sets, when that bird sings, when that child smiles. But if you could imagine a person who filled their lives with only the metaphors of money. This person is a stockbroker, and that's all they ever did with their lives. All they know is money, 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 stocks, securities, money, money. Could you imagine they're sitting there with the person they love the most? This is romance. Deeply staring into their beloved's eyes, their heart pounding, they say, "Sweetheart, your eyes, your deep brown eyes, remind me of shiny 1990 pennies." "I beg your pardon? Oh, no one's ever said that to me." "Oh, and the moon, as it's reflected on your silk skin, is like a silver dollar." "What? Oh, thank you. And that spring breeze, doesn't it remind you of fresh bills off the press?" Your language, your metaphors, will determine whether you can receive it or not. Some people's life just is so out of whack with what life is. Just can't receive it. Just can't receive the life. So the world to come in relationship to this world is like the experience of your wedding and the pictures of your wedding. Because, you know, if I can only share with you, I remember when I got out of the cab as I approached the wedding, I was blown away. I mean, people tell me I was there. I still deny it, but there's pictures. I don't remember being there. Our wedding was something like 5 hours long, non-stop dancing. So they tell me. And so I paid the band. And, I mean, it was like, and I got there, and they danced me towards the chuppah, towards the wedding canopy. I just, every step I took was like, up this way, and it was gone. I remember, after the wedding, when they were all dancing around, people were asking me if I need a drink of water because I look sick. Right? Are you okay? Are you sure you're okay? And I only could answer, what? Where am I? Who am I? And I was gone. I was just simply, it was like, the light was so overwhelming. The experience was just too much for my vessels to handle. You know why people cry at joyous occasions? Why do they cry? You cry when it's a sad time. Why do you cry at the happiest moments of your life? Because the light is so big, your vessels are breaking. You can't deal with it. You can't deal with it. You just break down and start to cry. It's just overwhelming. And my wedding was just overwhelming. I mean, for me, it lasted 5 minutes. That's what it felt like. But they tell me it was 5 hours. They tell me I said, I do, but I don't remember. I keep telling my wife that. But there are pictures. There are witnesses. When do you really enjoy your wedding? Not at your wedding. You're not there to enjoy it. You enjoy your wedding when you get the pictures. Because with the pictures, you're able to hold the light of the experience of your wedding. This world is taking the pictures before you get to the wedding of the next world. Because the next world, in its deepest metaphor, is like a wedding with God. And if you think your wedding is going to blow you away, wait until you get to this one. But with this one, there's no other way. You've got to take the pictures during the wedding, after the wedding, but before the wedding. Could you imagine being underneath your canopy but having the picture so you can look at it so it doesn't... You get in touch with it? So this world is the world of vessels. The next world's the world of light. In this world, we build the vessels in a manner that we can hold the light. That's the mitzvot. So why does it say, and I'll give you rain that's time, grass for your cows? What am I going to do in this world? What will mitzvot do in the world? The mitzvot will create a harmonious world that will reflect the harmony of the next world. The mitzvot will create a world that will reflect the harmony of the next world. Become the holy metaphor to receive the light of the next world. What are mitzvot all about? They synchronize our life with the way of God. And the world will reflect that unity and will prepare us to accept that unity in the next world, in the afterlife. This world is a function of your relationship with God and with your fellow man. The Zohar says that when Yaakov, the patriarch, was on his way down to Egypt to see his son for the first time after many, many years, God said to Jacob, do not fear Yosef will close your eyes. Okay, good. What does that mean? The Zohar says, why is it when someone dies, you have to close their eyes? According to Jewish law, you have to close their eyes. And Jacob was being comforted that his eyes will be closed by Yosef. Don't worry, someone will close your eyes. Yosef will make sure that when you die in Egypt, he'll close your eyes. The Zohar says, why? Because the colors, the textures, the forms of this world are in your eyes. So if you want to see the next world, someone's going to have to close your eyes. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that this world is an illusion, God forbid. It means this world is a perception. This world is a conceptualization, a function of your relationships with your fellow man, with God. And based on your relationship with God and fellow mankind will determine whether this world will reflect the next world, which will be that pure relationship in its ultimate form. So therefore, what am I getting for the mitzvot? I'm not getting the world to come. The world to come is coming anyway. But I'm preparing myself by investing in those areas of life that make the eternal difference. That's what the Jews live with. That's what mitzvot mean to the Jewish people. It prepares us. It establishes our relationship with God, establishes our relationship with mankind, and it creates the world. The world that you see is a function of the relationships you create. And this is already something that is accepted from a quantum physics point of view. That the world isn't things, but conceptualization of relationships. And this is quite coordinated with Jewish tradition. But then it says, okay, if you listen to my mitzvot, give you rain in its time, everything will be in sync. Cows will eat grass. They won't have to go off in strange places right there. And you, yes, you will be able to gather your vineyards, and your olive groves, and your wheat. And you'll eat and you'll be satisfied. You'll eat. You won't have to eat too much to be satisfied. And then it goes, watch out, lest you stray, serve other gods, bow down to them, and then the synchronized world, the harmonious world will break down. There won't be any rain. There won't be any produce. Now, what happened? Everything was going wonderful. And all of a sudden, I'm being warned, watch out. It didn't say, if you do this, you'll get X. If you don't do this, you'll lose X. It didn't say that. So if you do this, the mitzvot, you'll get a harmonious world. Now that you're in a harmonious world, watch out, lest your heart would stray. Why would my heart stray? Why would my heart stray? The Talmud says, and you shall eat and be satisfied, and watch out. So the Talmud says, you know when things break down? When you eat too much. It's an amazing thing. Eat and be satisfied, don't eat any more than that, because overeating feeds the Yetzer Hara. That's what the Zohar says. Overeating feeds your evil inclination. Only on Shabbat are you allowed to overeat. Thank God there's Shabbat, right?
Yeah.
Only on Shabbat you're allowed to eat more. But during the week, overeating fills your evil inclination. It feeds the illusion of your separateness. It feeds your body. And I'm not saying bodies are an illusion, but bodies suggest the illusion of separateness. But it goes even deeper than that. I mean, of course, it's also that. But there's another approach included. Of course, why at this point would it say, and watch out? Because people allow that which is perfect order to become ordinary. Perfect order. The beauty, the awe of order, when seen once, twice, three times, becomes ordinary. People want People want miracles, right? People want miracles. Oh, I want a miracle. Oh, I want a miracle. So for people, a miracle would be, you know, all of a sudden, Twin Towers turning over and standing on its head. Wow, that's a miracle. For some reason, something that happens once is a miracle. And it's something that happens every single day. Well, that's nature, right? Because it happens more than once. It should be more of a miracle, right? This morning the sun rises. Oh, it's a miracle. Did you see the sun rise? No, I never saw it. What a miracle. Next morning, oh, it does that every day. It's not a miracle. Why is it a miracle? Because it happened more than once. So people want something really unbelievable. Because something that's order is not awesome anymore. For some strange reason, science substitutes God. Ridiculous, right? Science, after showing there's order to the world, instead of enhancing the faith in God, all of a sudden, substituted the faith in God. Oh, we thought it was created by God. Well, now that it's all in order, I guess there is no God. Does that make sense? I mean, the scientist starts off with this assumption that there must be patterns to the universe, which of course is ridiculous to assume for a Big Bang. And what's even more ridiculous is you actually isolate and articulate, yes, indeed, principles, patterns, direction, and all of a sudden science. Does that make any sense? Order becomes ordinary. So what do you need when order becomes ordinary? What do you need to resensitize yourself? You need the extraordinary. Right? Order becomes ordinary. Ordinary needs extraordinary to get back to say, oh, where was the order? Where was the order? Basically, in a nutshell, this is reflected in the history of the media. This is reflected in the history of rock and roll. Because, did you ever wonder, for the older people in the group, why Jimi Hendrix burns his guitar? Why do you do that? It's such an expensive guitar. Why would you burn your guitar? And then, to take very talented musicians like The Who, and at the end of a concert, destroy all the Fender equipment, and that's what you paid to see. I mean, if they didn't do it, oh, I want my money back. I want to see them take their guitars and use them like axes. Right? And destroy everything. Oh, that'll be wonderful. Right. Did you ever wonder why, how it's possible that a person could become famous because they excreted on stage like Frank Zappa? How is that possible? Why would that be the claim to fame? This guy becomes a millionaire because he's crazy enough to pull his pants down and excrete on stage in front of hundreds of people, thousands of people. Right? It's unbelievable. Right. And then, thanks to genius perverts like Frank Zappa, you can quote me on that one. He's in a bar one day, a nightclub, and he sees an act that he says, this is truly brilliant, this is music. Who did he see? Who did he discover? A fellow dressed up like a woman, singing songs with a live cobra around his body, calling himself Alice Cooper. Right? And he said, Frank said, after he had a problem, a couple hundred drinks, this guy's got talent. Right? This guy's got talent. And I want you to know Alice Cooper, which they say he came from Dennis the Menace or something. I don't know what show they say he was from. But anyways, the Alice Cooper, because this big famous fellow, you know what Alice Cooper would do on stage? First of all, Alice Cooper, a man, would come out on stage, dressed like a woman, with a live cobra around his body, singing songs about snakes. Then after that, he takes out of the pocket of his dress a baby doll. Then from his other pocket, he takes out a hatchet. He sings a song called Dead Babies. And in front of thousands of people who paid to see this, of course, he hatchets this little plastic baby doll into pieces, and he throws the pieces at the audience while people are frantically jumping to try and get a piece of baby plastic baby doll. I'll show you mine. I'm just joking. I didn't get one. I tried. No. And then after that, he sings a song about chickens. Takes out live chickens and swings them around his head. And we're not talking about before Yom Kippur either. Right? Swings these live chickens around his head and then throws live chickens at the audience. Can you imagine? And for dessert, he takes a watermelon. Of course, all this is part of the songs, right? He takes a watermelon and he jumps all over it and kicks it at the audience. And you have to understand, you paid $15, $20 to have watermelon all over your face, right? But if he kicked it at me, it's worth it, right? And then, to digest, his entire band hangs him on stage, right? They bring him up to a gallery and they put him on a noose and they hang him on stage with the perfect synchronization of the entire stadium going completely dark with a piercing white spotlight on his dead face. And then all of a sudden, boom, the place goes completely dark. Boom, the place goes completely light, and Alice Cooper's dancing in a white tuxedo. Funny guy. Right. People pay to see this. People pay. It has nothing to do with music anymore. Right? People now have to work in a circus before they get into the music business. They paint their faces. They eat fire. They don't play music. And then it goes on and on and on. Punk rockers. You know, there's a famous punk rock band that became famous because you can be sure that all the equipment they're using is stolen. Right? That was like their claim to fame. Everything they're using has been completely ripped off. Right? Wow. What? And then in the sports, of course, sports is becoming fun. People like Evel Knievel, who feel they have to prove themselves to their mothers. I guess it must be to their mothers. To jump the Fountain Blue. I mean, you know, it goes on and on and on. And then the movies. You know, once upon a time, it was really gory. At the last scene of Bonnie and Clyde, that behind the bushes, and all of a sudden, you see a little blood dripple down underneath the bushes. Go, wow, oh, yeah. Right? But you think the next movie could do that? That's boring. That's boring, right? Now we need a slow motion murder scene where we see the bullet slowly approaching the guy's head and then the blood splurts all over the screen. Ah, oh, that's wonderful. But of course, after they put that one out, you kidding? Right? That would never make it. So they'll have to think of more gruesome ways. To the extent that you know what they're doing now? They're actually producing home movies of real murders called Snuffing It. $100 a head. Right? Tickets are $100 in the States. It's the newest fad. These are movies, these are not staged rapes, staged murders. These are murders and real rapes. Wow. Sensationalism. What is sensationalism? It's the most desensitizing media. They call it sensationalism. You know why they call it sensationalism? Because there are no senses left to this person. There's no senses left, so you have to, it's like, you know what it's like? It's like when people are depressed, they used to give them shock treatment. People are so depressed, the media is simply shock treatment. Simply shock treatment. That's what's going on. People's senses are so numb. Why do people go to these kinds of movies? Why do people go to these kinds of concerts? Because when you come out of that concert or that movie and you look at a bird, you say, wow, a bird. It's so good to see something normal. Sensationalism for the Jewish people is hold an apple and make a bracha. That's sensationalism. Sensationalism is reach into your pocket and give that person some tzedakah, some charity. That's sensationalism. Sensationalism is what Judaism is. Judaism is the most sensational religion around. When you're talking about sensationalism. So, if you do not appreciate and recognize the order, if it takes paving paradise and putting up a parking lot in order to appreciate, hey, what happened to paradise? When order and beauty become commonplace and you get used to it, that's when God says, okay, fine, then stop up the sky. If you need the extraordinary, so I'll bring the extraordinary so that you will then once again realize what you thought was ordinary is actually the most harmonious, perfect, divine order. So the second paragraph is the communal responsibility that the community, as a community, controls the way the world looks for the world, and the reward and the punishment is not simply an added effect to your mitzvot, but the truth is they are the most direct results of your life patterns.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.